Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France stands as one of the most profound political treatises ever written, a work that transcends its immediate historical context to offer timeless insights about human society and governance. Published in 1790, just as the French Revolution was unfolding, Burke's masterpiece became an instant sensation, selling over 30,000 copies in its first 2 years, an extraordinary figure for the time. The book's influence extends far beyond its era. Margaret Thatcher famously carried a copy in her handbag, while philosophers from Leo Strauss to Alasdair MacIntyre have acknowledged its foundational importance to conservative thought. Yet what makes this work truly remarkable is how Burke's warnings about revolutionary excess and ideological fanaticism would prove prophetic not just for France, but for subsequent revolutions throughout history. In an age where radical political transformations continue to reshape societies worldwide, Burke's voice remains a necessary counterbalance to utopian impulses, reminding us that genuine progress requires respect for the accumulated wisdom embedded in existing institutions. Burke's fundamental critique of the French Revolution centered on its embodiment of Hobbesian political theory, the dangerous notion that society could be dismantled and rebuilt from scratch according to abstract principles. For Burke, human passion was the root problem of politics. History, he observed, largely consists of the miseries brought upon the world by pride, ambition, avarice, revenge, lust, sedition, hypocrisy, ungoverned zeal, and all the train of disorderly appetites that disrupt both public and private life. What made Burke's analysis so penetrating was his recognition that revolutionary ideologies could spread across borders like contagions. The French Revolution had demonstrated the possibility of toppling monarchy, legislature, and church based on radical ideological models. Burke understood that the concepts of rights of man and popular sovereignty, without constituted authority to define them, represented a fundamental danger to stable governance. Burke's politics represents the thinking, skeptical liberal who recognizes the inherent complexity in political life. He invites profound discussion of how fundamentally free societies can preserve freedom, maintain civility, and protect themselves from external threats. However, his vision remains incomplete, particularly regarding equality. While denouncing the false equality of tyranny, Burke also rejected most efforts towards social and political equality as perverting the natural order. He believed property ownership demonstrated success in the difficulty and struggle that qualified one for government, views that appear illiberal by modern standards but aligned with Lockean defenses of unequal property distribution. When Burke published his Reflections in November 1790, France had already transformed dramatically. The formation of the National Assembly, the fall of the Bastille, rural riots, nobles surrendering feudal rights, the Declaration of the Rights of Man, the royal family's forced return to Paris, church land confiscation, administrative reconstruction, and clergy loyalty oaths. Burke's response to these changes caused enormous controversy in England, breaking friendships and splitting his Whig party as he defended existing institutions against radical change. Burke framed his work as a letter to a young French gentleman expressing deep concerns about revolutionary proceedings while affirming his own commitment to rational liberty and the principles of England's glorious revolution of 1688. This epistolary format allowed him to combine personal warmth with political wisdom, making his critique both intimate and universal. He distinguished himself from two London societies, the Constitutional Society and the Revolution Society, that had publicly congratulated the French National Assembly. Burke vehemently criticized these clubs not only for presuming to speak on behalf of England without proper authority, but also for their dangerous oversimplification of complex political realities. The heart of Burke's argument was that liberty must be judged not abstractly, but within specific circumstances and institutions. Liberty, when men act in bodies, is power, he warned, urging prudence before celebrating France's revolution. This insight reflected his understanding that freedom exists not in philosophical treatises, but in the lived experience of communities. True liberty, in Burke's view, must be combined with government, public force, revenue collection, morality, property rights, and social order. It cannot exist in isolation as a pure abstraction. He illustrated this through numerous historical examples, from ancient Rome to contemporary Britain, showing how liberty flourished only when properly balanced with other social goods. Burke's insights came from long observation and genuine impartiality. As he noted, his opinions came from one who has been no tool of power nor flatterer of greatness, whose public life has been a struggle for others' liberty, angered only by tyranny. His credentials were impressive: decades of parliamentary service, advocacy for American colonists' rights, opposition to the East India Company's excesses, and consistent support for religious tolerance. He took from his efforts against opulent oppression the hours spent analyzing French affairs, desiring little in honors and expecting none. This independence of mind allowed him to preserve consistency while varying means to secure unity of end. When society's balance was endangered by overloading one side, Burke carried his small weight of reasons to preserve its equipoise. This approach, pragmatic, measured, and deeply attuned to the complexity of human affairs, stands in stark contrast to the revolutionary fervor he criticized. For Burke, liberty wasn't a slogan, but a delicate achievement requiring careful nurturing and protection. He understood that political freedom emerges gradually through the accumulated wisdom of generations, not through sudden revolutionary upheaval. Burke's perspective emphasized the importance of inherited institutions, cultural traditions, and social bonds in sustaining genuine liberty. His warnings about abstract theorizing remain relevant today, reminding us that true freedom requires more than philosophical declarations. It demands practical wisdom, historical understanding, and careful attention to social context. History has vindicated many of Burke's warnings about revolutionary excess with remarkable precision. His thesis of an armed doctrine proved especially prescient as France under Bonaparte transformed into a manically expansionist power, with which conventional diplomatic relations and peace negotiations became essentially impossible. Burke's insight was particularly acute in recognizing that France remained fundamentally dangerous even after the Thermidorian reaction had moderated some of the revolution's most extreme excesses, a pattern that would repeat itself in future revolutions. More profoundly, Burke anticipated how later revolutions would follow the French pattern of attempting to remake entire societies upon a theory. Under communist regimes, as under the Jacobins, professions of public virtue were systematically used to suppress and destroy private virtues and traditional social bonds. The communists emerged as direct intellectual and tactical heirs of the Jacobins, implementing similar patterns of ideological purification and social transformation. National socialism's debt to this revolutionary tradition was less obvious but equally substantial. Though Hitler explicitly rejected the French Revolution's egalitarian rhetoric, he was deeply attracted by two crucial aspects: the breathtaking audacity of its innovations in restructuring society, and the ruthless ferocity with which revolutionaries suppressed any resistance to their vision. National socialism descended from the Völkisch tradition of 19th-century Germany, a potent mixture of nationalist fervor, virulent anti-Semitism, scientific racism, militant expansionism, and revolutionary zeal. Richard Wagner's apocalyptic vision of revolution as the ever-fashioning life and the only God powerfully exemplified this tradition, merging romantic German nationalism with revolutionary mysticism. The German revolutionaries of 1848 created a crucial synthesis, blending French revolutionary mystique with Völkisch ideas and representing a critical transition between French and German revolutionary thought that ultimately culminated in the National Socialist Revolution of 1933-45. The Third Reich emerged as history's most far-reaching and systematic effort to reconstruct society upon a theory, specifically that of racial hygiene, with the Holocaust as its most horrific practical application. While Hitler openly despised the universalist theories of the French and Russian revolutions, he followed and ultimately surpassed their examples in applying his own theoretic dogma with unprecedented audacity and ferocity. His regime demonstrated the ultimate consequences of attempting to remake society through ideological purification, combining modern bureaucratic efficiency with revolutionary fervor. The course and consequences of the 20th century's three great revolutions, the Bolshevik Revolution, the National Socialist Revolution, and Mao's Cultural Revolution, confirmed on an awesome and tragic scale Burke's prescient warnings against attempts to reconstruct whole societies based on abstract theory, showing how such attempts inevitably lead to catastrophic human costs. Burke's characterization of the French Enlightenment philosophers drew heavily from French counter-Enlightenment narratives, offering a penetrating critique of intellectual movements that would prove prescient. These critics portrayed philosophers as power-hungry intellectuals who strategically concealed their true ambitions behind noble-sounding slogans of tolerance, humanity, and freedom. According to this perspective, they had methodically infiltrated mainstream society through salons, academies, and publications, gradually weakening traditional family structures, promoting individualistic selfishness over communal bonds, and deliberately fostering political rebellion against established authorities. In the Reflections, Burke argued that unlike England's occasional independent freethinkers, French philosophers had consciously organized themselves into a formal corps or faction in the state, a distinction he saw as crucial. He meticulously traced their origins to the post-Louis XIV era when they systematically formed their own incorporation through the prestigious academies and the ambitious Encyclopedia Project. Through these institutions, they engaged in what Burke termed abstract literary politics, while systematically targeting the Catholic Church for destruction, viewing it as the primary obstacle to their revolutionary agenda. Though perhaps exaggerated as a comprehensive causal explanation for the revolution, Burke's conspiracy rhetoric had powerful contemporary appeal in a Europe watching French events with mounting alarm and trepidation. Ironically, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, ostensibly Burke's philosophical adversary, had written a remarkably similar philosoph conspiracy theory years earlier, describing them as practitioners of philosophic intolerance who governed minds with monkish inflexibility and operated a philosophic inquisition that brooked no dissent from their orthodoxy. Burke's particular insight was recognizing the potentially religious-like fanaticism lurking within the ostensibly secular philosophy of the French Enlightenment. These atheistical fathers have a bigotry of their own, he noted with characteristic perspicacity, and they have learned to talk against monks with the spirit of a monk. What Burke was identifying and condemning in its earliest manifestation is what we now recognize as modern ideology, demonstrating remarkable foresight about the power of modern intellectuals to produce absolutist systems of thought that could prove as dogmatic as any religious doctrine. However, in his final years, as the revolution degenerated into bloody terror, Burke's own discernment began to falter. His enthusiastic praise for Abbé Barwell's vitriolic conspiracy tract suggests that while attempting to remove the log from the enlightened eye, Burke may have left a dangerous speck in his own, failing to recognize that reactionary clerks on the right would also commit ideological treason, some regrettably invoking Burke's own name in service of their cause. This blind spot reveals how even the most insightful critics can sometimes fall prey to the very absolutist thinking they set out to oppose. A striking contrast to the French revolutionary failure was the remarkable success of the American constitutional experiment. A satirical cartoon from 1798 perfectly captured what Burke had predicted. The French Directory frantically drafting and discarding constitutions, with Napoleon writing and Abbé Sieyès filing away forgotten constitutional documents. While France became notorious for constitutional instability, spawning the political science joke about French constitutions being periodical literature, the American model treated a constitution as fundamental law adopted at a specific historical moment, subject only to occasional amendment and judicial interpretation, while maintaining its original authority. Though Burke would have preferred Britain's revolution principles of 1688-89 to America's written constitution, the stark contrast between American constitutional stability and French constitutional chaos raises important questions about why American constitutionalism succeeded where French efforts failed. Seven crucial factors explain this American success. First, the conditions of deliberation. The Philadelphia Convention met in complete secrecy from May to September 1787, with delegates insulated from populist pressures. This contrasted with Burke's horrified description of the French National Assembly acting like comedians of a fair before a riotous audience amid tumultuous cries of a mixed mob. Second, the American framers benefited from arriving largely uninstructed by their states regarding the scope of their deliberations. Unlike the French deputies with their community grievances, cahiers, the Americans could more freely consider the best constitutional framework. Third, the framers understood they were only proposing, not imposing, a constitution. The people would need to ratify it through specially elected conventions, providing legitimacy that France's constitution never achieved. Fourth was the presence of leading voices. The American Constitution emerged from a small, cohesive, deliberative body, contrasting sharply with the large, polyglot membership of the French National Assembly. James Madison exercised profound influence despite losing on his key proposals, having concluded the Union needed to act directly upon citizens through a proper national government with three distinct departments. Fifth was the framers' ability to learn from experience. By 1787, Americans possessed something European reformers lacked: a decade of constitutional innovation, beginning with the first state constitutions in the mid-1770s. This hard-earned experience allowed them to recognize past mistakes, like eviscerating executive power in favor of legislative supremacy. Sixth was the puzzle of federalism. Unlike the French revolutionaries' destruction of historical boundaries, American framers had to determine boundaries between national supremacy and state sovereignty. After 7 weeks debating representation, they reached the Great Compromise, giving each state two senators, regardless of population. Finally, the politics of compromise. The convention structure emerged gradually through prosaic decisions rather than grand design. Madison grounded his reform agenda on the principle that the new government should have genuine legislative power over citizens, not just authority to make recommendations to states. The representation question dominated the first 7 weeks of debate, with Madison arguing that citizens, not states, were the true units of representation. The French Revolution emerged from Enlightenment thinking that had asserted political, economic, and social problems could be subjected to rationalistic analysis modeled after the natural sciences. Though few Enlightenment thinkers had favored democratic solutions, indeed many consulted with enlightened absolutists, the National Assembly's radical reconstruction of French society along rationalist lines created a lasting association between rational analysis and liberal democracy. This relationship between democracy and social science contains inherent tensions. The rational analysis of society, what we now call social science, need not be compatible with democracy. Early political thinkers like Plato, Aristotle, Machiavelli, and Hobbes were hardly democrats. Economics emerged before universal suffrage, while sociology's founders often harbored doubts about democracy. Yet democracy and social science have expanded in tandem. This elective affinity manifests in modern polling techniques, which only matter when public opinion counts, and in statecraft. Before modern democracy, government was limited in power and locally concentrated. Progressives advocated expanded government roles in providing social services and regulating business. The New Deal cemented relationships between democratic expansion, governmental growth, social science respectability, and academics' participation in government. Despite this seemingly natural relationship between democracy and rational social science, Burke questioned this connection immediately upon witnessing the French Revolution. The revolutionaries, having toppled monarchy and its principles of hereditary rule and tradition, needed new principles to build a government upon. They embraced what Burke saw as an extensive yet naive belief in human reason. Burke understood that human nature isn't fixed by biology, but includes a second nature, what we'd call culture. When society's influence adds to natural endowments, humans become complicated creatures with many diversities according to birth, education, professions, periods of lives, residence. Wise legislators recognize this diversity, but ambitious planners treat humans as interchangeable units. By stripping away inherited characteristics evolved over time and placing people into rationally chosen categories, the revolutionaries created a new tyranny, reducing citizens to loose counters merely for simple telling. Burke anticipated mass society theory, warning that abolishing intermediate associations would leave citizens naked before the state, causing France to decay into the dust and powder of individuality. Burke was conservatism's founder, and his critiques of rationality-based plans were carried forward by 20th-century conservative thinkers like Michael Oakeshott, who warned against ambitious intellectual agendas, Leo Strauss, who criticized American social science's empirical focus, and neoconservatives, who founded the Public Interest magazine, arguing that public policies often produced unintended consequences. Ironically, by the late 20th century, 1960s radicals developed critiques of rationality remarkably similar to Burke's, though few had read him. Their writings about Vietnam war planning echoed his themes. The best and brightest war planners with prestigious degrees approached warfare through game theory and mathematical modeling while ignoring Vietnamese history, just as the National Assembly had ignored French traditions. The arbitrary division of Vietnam resembled the arbitrary departmental lines drawn in 1789 France. Both efforts failed by disregarding history, tradition, and human complexity. These radicals' critique drew philosophical inspiration not from Burke, but from inheritors of the French revolutionary tradition he despised, particularly Michel Foucault. Despite this irony, Foucault's arguments resembled Burke's. Knowledge accumulation serves political ends, and classification systems contain people to exercise tyranny over them. Despite these critiques, theoretical rationality didn't die, but transformed. In humanities, Foucault's ideas elevated theory to an exalted position. In social sciences, radical caucuses protested knowledge as power, but claimed to be more scientific than mainstream scholars. Economics became increasingly mathematical, assuming individuals calculate benefits and losses rationally. Burke feared rational categorization of people would expose them to tyranny. While academic rational choice theories may not directly threaten democracy broadly, their influence has significant implications. Unlike mid-20th century social scientists, who often served as public intellectuals engaged with society's pressing questions, today's rational choice theorists pursue rationality for its own sake, showing little interest in actual politics or democratic engagement. Yet Burke's alternative, defending prejudice because it engages the mind in a steady course of wisdom and virtue without hesitation, has serious limitations. Liberal democracies value skepticism, encouraging citizens to examine received ideas critically rather than accepting them on authority. Democratic governance involves mutual testing between rulers and the ruled, with people asking leaders to consider their views while rulers seek permission to make rules in the first place. Social science plays an important role in this skeptical democratic framework, helping citizens test whether their dispositions correspond with reality. At its best, social science provides tools to overcome prejudice while protecting against revolutionary urges from both left and right by revealing unintended consequences of policies and demonstrating that social conditions are often not as dire as claimed. Like Burke, Max Weber warned against those who seized power claiming they would do good things for society. Weber advocated an ethic of responsibility for both politicians and scientists, urging humility and respect for human beings. The danger comes not from the quest for knowledge itself, but from those who lack humility in pursuing it. Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France offers a profound meditation on the nature of political change that remains remarkably relevant today. His core insight that societies are complex, organic entities that cannot be redesigned according to abstract blueprints without causing immense suffering has been vindicated repeatedly throughout modern history, from the French Revolution's Reign of Terror to the catastrophic social engineering experiments of the 20th century. Burke's analysis rests on a sophisticated understanding of how societies evolve and function. He viewed social institutions as repositories of accumulated wisdom, shaped by countless adjustments and corrections over generations. These institutions, from legal systems to cultural practices, represent not just arbitrary traditions, but tested solutions to complex social problems. The Parliament of England, for instance, embodied centuries of practical refinements in balancing various interests and powers within society. What makes Burke's work so enduring is not its defense of the status quo, but its advocacy for prudent reform that respects the accumulated wisdom embedded in existing institutions. He rejected both implacable conservatism that defends everything existing and uninhibited radicalism that discards everything old. Instead, he advocated reform that preserves useful parts of an old establishment while carefully fitting new additions to what's retained, requiring a vigorous mind, steady attention, powers of comparison and combination. Burke's approach acknowledges that meaningful change often requires patience and careful consideration. He supported, for example, the American Revolution because it aimed to preserve established rights and liberties, while opposing the French Revolution for its radical attempt to rebuild society from scratch. His support for Catholic emancipation and opposition to the slave trade demonstrated how principled reform could address injustice without destabilizing the entire social fabric. This balanced approach to social change offers a vital middle path between rigid traditionalism and revolutionary fervor. It suggests that effective reform requires deep understanding of existing institutions, careful assessment of potential consequences, and recognition that social change should be evolutionary rather than revolutionary. Burke's framework helps explain why gradual reforms, like Britain's steady path to democratic governance, often prove more durable than radical upheavals. In our age of polarization and ideological certainty, Burke's voice of prudent skepticism remains as necessary as ever. His insights can guide us in addressing contemporary challenges, from technological disruption to social inequality, reminding us that genuine progress requires both moral vision and practical wisdom, the capacity to recognize injustice while understanding the limits of human reason in designing perfect societies. The wisdom of prudent progress suggests that sustainable change comes not from grand theories or sudden transformations, but from careful, iterative improvements that build upon rather than destroy what came before.